Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we hear both sides of the debate over continuing oversight of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office.
And what the shutdown of a decades-old writing program suggests about the future of humanities at the U of A.
But first, Tucson residents have been up in arms about a proposed data center dubbed Project Blue. The project, which is tied to tech giant Amazon, would have been built on 290 acres of unincorporated land the developer wanted annexed into Tucson so it could access water supplies. But as residents relentlessly pointed out, that's water that Tucson desperately needs. Well, yesterday, the Tucson City Council heard those constituents loud and clear. Council members voted unanimously against bringing the massive project to Tucson. The move was cheered by a big crowd gathered at council chambers, and our first guest this morning was there. Yana Kunichoff is a reporter for Arizona Luminaria in Tucson, and she's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning, Yana.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. So this has been a roller coaster to cover, I'm sure. Tell us first what exactly Project Blue would have looked like.
Yeah, so there's so many questions still about Project Blue, but what we did know was that it was a data center that was proposed that would eventually have been accessed into the city of Tucson. It would have been initially been over 290 acres, would have used millions of gallons of water for the first few years, actually would have relied on potable water, which means drinking water, before eventually working with the city of Tucson to build a renewable water pipeline. But what's crucial is that this was just the first of three proposed phases, that there were sort of murky details about the last two. And we also, there was no public confirmation of who the end user was, but the news organization I work for, Arizona Luminaria, was able to get a document through a public records request that told us it would be Amazon Web Services. So we had some information and there were still a lot of big questions.
Right. So this really outraged a lot of people in Tucson. We saw a massive community meeting earlier this week and lots of concerns about how this all went down, right?
Yeah, I think that there was so much, there was concern about the project, but there was also so much anger and I think just mistrust around the process, both from the company and public officials.
What did the company have to say, Yana, after this vote yesterday in which the city council sort of said, we're not going to move forward with this annexation?
The company sent a statement that said that they were disappointed in Tucson, that they felt like they had worked hard to kind of win the trust of community members by participating in these public meetings that the city of Tucson had put together ahead of the city council's first discussion on the project. But I think it's important to say that a really big vote on the project, which was the Pima County Board of Supervisors selling a big part of its unincorporated land to the developers, happened before there was really any public meetings and, again, any information about who the final user of the project was.
But this doesn't mean that Project Blue is over, right? Like, this could still very well happen, just in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, the really big bombshell of information, or one of them, was when City Council member Nikki Lee said that she had talked to folks that were part of the development process, and they had said that even if Tucson didn't agree, that they were still planning in some way to build a data center in the region. I think there's big questions about how or where they would access the amount of water that a data center needs, because being annexed to Tucson would give access to Tucson water. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of big questions still, and we've reached out and haven't gotten firm answers.
Okay. So there are debates about these data centers and how much power and water they use going on kind of all over, but lots of cities in Phoenix, in the Phoenix area, are doing this right now, talking about how to regulate this. This also spurred that conversation, that debate in Tucson, right, about creating some kind of ordinance that would somehow limit data centers there?
Yeah, and that's the next step. Council members, when they unequivocally said no to continuing to negotiate with Project Blue, said that their next step, even at the next meeting on August 19th, will be to start working on this ordinance. And I think that the experience of Valley Cities, Tempe, Mesa, Phoenix is going to be really big in what things look like in Tucson.
Right. And they're still being built data centers all over right now, right? I mean, tell us more about the concerns about water usage, power usage. Are they not regulated at this point in most places?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what we have seen, so first of all, like Tucson was saying, no desert data center, but obviously there are data centers in the Sonoran Desert and in the desert already. So data centers use a large amount of water for cooling the kind of like the large computers and machines that are inside them. But I think a lot of what we've seen in other communities is there's what a data center or a company promises in a written agreement. And then, for example, like you've seen in Mississippi, there's turbines that have a data center that's run by one of Elon Musk's companies that has been running without environmental safeguards, because on paper, those turbines are seen as temporary. So there's a lot of promises made. And at the same time, there's ways that these like large multinational corporations are able to kind of find loopholes that residents say hurts their communities, resources, and their health.
Last question for you here, Yana, in the last minute or so. This has brought up, again, kind of a long time debate in Tucson about creating a public power option there. What would that look like?
Yeah, I was surprised that was brought into the, it makes sense that it was brought into this conversation, but Paul Cunningham, the city council member, has sort of been kind of not entirely on board with that. But basically there's been a campaign here for just about a year for Tucson to take over the electric utility. And so I think in some ways that would allow the city to move more clearly toward its green energy goals. It's also, as I understand it, if Tucson tries to take over the electric power utility, it would have to buy a certain amount of its debt. There's kind of it's a really big financial and logistical decision, but I think it would put the power for rate hikes and like the experience of how much Tucson residents pay for power in the hands of the government body rather than a private corporation, which it is right now.
All right. Well, lots to watch for. We'll leave it there. Yana Kunichov, reporter for Arizona Luminaria in Tucson. Yana, thank you for your reporting here. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
The University of Arizona is shutting down its decades-old writing skills improvement program this fall. Since the 1980s, the program has offered U of A students, as well as middle and high school students, training and development in writing and critical thinking. U of A says similar resources will still be available from other channels at the university, but the program's demise has raised concerns about the school's plans for the future. For more on this, we are joined now by Tucson Spotlight co-founder Caitlin Schmidt. Caitlin, good morning.
Good morning.
Caitlin, tell us a little bit more about what exactly the Writing Skills Improvement Program has historically offered.
So the Writing Skills Improvement Program was created in the early 1980s, and it was kind of a three-tiered program that provided training, mentoring, and guidance to the UA campus community, so students, faculty, and staff. But it also provided support and training for middle and high school students and mentoring for teachers to help with professional development as well.
Okay, so this wasn't just an opportunity for students to develop writing skills. This was also a way for teachers to kind of get real-time kind of in-classroom work developing their teaching skills.
Yep, continuing education in a state where resources are already so scarce for teachers. So this was a really big part of the community, and people have definitely expressed some concern about what will happen. There are still resources available for UA students and the campus community. But those resources that are on campus are not yet available to members outside of the UA community.
And those resources, if I'm not mistaken, are the Foundations Program and the Think Tank Writing Center. How are those different from the program that's being shut down?
So the Foundations Program is a pair of English courses that students take as part of their general education. But if a student comes in with AP Honors credits, they only have to take one of those classes. And the Think Tank Writing Center is similar to the Writing Skills Improvement Program, except that instead of being staffed by professionals, which were tutors, teachers, writers, editors. This is staffed by peer tutors, so other students.
I see. And then obviously, critically there, if you're a middle or high school student in the community, these programs would not be available to you as they're currently designed, right?
Yes, and I haven't heard that any plans to expand them as of yet. The program is still up and running until early October, until they kind of figure out how to restructure, but then it will be phased out.
What reasons has the U of A given for shutting down the Writing Skills Improvement Program?
They really didn't give a reason when we asked about it. They let us know that it was not part of the overall restructuring. We've seen a lot of changes being made over the summer to the campus cultural centers and some different staffing moves around the campus community. But this, they said, was a decision that was made independently by the College of Humanities. So it's not a part of any of these larger restructurings or any response to federal guidance, as far as I know.
Interesting. I was going to ask about that because, if I'm not mistaken, back in May, there were 10 full-time writing faculty members that did not have their contracts renewed, right?
Yes. That was not related, as far as I know. And then we've seen some other staffing shakeups, mostly in the campus cultural centers, but in different parts of the campus as well, related to either orders on DEI or perhaps some funding that maybe the U of A lost through grants or research. But this sounds like it was not related to any of that.
Do we know what enrollment is looking like this fall at the U of A? At the time of those reported cuts to the full-time writing staff, I think freshman enrollment was going to be closer to 7,000, down from about 9,000 the previous year.
Yep, that's what they're still looking at. My reporter, Sarah, who wrote this story for us, is digging into that right now. Campus enrollment across the board is down. It still looks like it should be in that 7,000 range, but we'll have a better idea as we get a little closer. We have students coming back next week or the week after, so we should know pretty soon.
Interesting. I realize, you know, you're saying that the university is not saying that this has anything to do with some of the broader issues that the U of A is facing, but obviously the school has been dealing with really serious financial issues. We do know that there have been pretty serious investments in other academic areas, space sciences, national security, energy, mineral mining, healthcare, tech. Is it notable to you that there is a lot of investment going in other directions, whereas these programs are being trimmed?
I mean, those certainly are the programs that also bring in the most money, right?
Right.
Their writing isn't very lucrative, especially if anyone in journalism or writing as a career knows.
Unfortunately.
But, yeah, absolutely. Those research fields bring in billions of dollars in grants and funding and notoriety. U of A is on lists every year for their inventions and the number of patents that they that are issued to their students and researchers. And I don't think, you know, their writing skills program probably brings the same kind of return for investment. It absolutely was something that was very nice for the community. But, you know, when the U of A is tightening its belt on all fronts, I guess it does make sense that they might scale back some of their offerings to people outside of the UA community.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of hard, Caitlin, I think, to read a story like this and not think about a lot of other stories we've seen about the role of AI at colleges and universities, particularly when it comes to students writing papers and that sort of thing. Have you heard anything to suggest that AI is part of this story, in particular U of A's investment in AI?
I haven't. And I know, you know, there is not an across-the-board AI policy at the U of A, so every college is kind of making ours up as they go, which I know for students is complicated. I teach a class over in the journalism school, and over there, there wasn't a uniform AI policy. Every teacher kind of set their own. And I know that that's complicated for students to keep that straight. So, you know, it's tough to say what role AI plays into this. I know for a lot of educators, we're kind of bracing ourselves. I don't know why anyone is going into journalism classes and then using AI to write. But that certainly is what we're seeing happening across that. And the U of A definitely has said that AI is a priority for it going forward. We are seeing deep investments in artificial intelligence. And so it kind of tracks with the research spending and goals that we've set.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for today. That is Caitlin Schmidt, reporter and co-founder of the Tucson Spotlight. Caitlin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, there's no shortage of science fiction stories where robots turn on humankind. But what if future robots just want to open a noodle shop? But first, there has been a court-appointed monitor overseeing the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office for more than a decade. It's the result of a lawsuit filed against former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, accusing the office of systematically racially profiling Latino drivers for traffic stops. The judge found it was true and appointed a monitor to oversee court-ordered efforts to remedy the problem. But it's 11 years later, and that monitor is still at it, and MCSO is very close to finishing the job. It only needs to sustain compliance on a number of requirements for 3 years. There have been three sheriffs since Arpaio's reign. The one who unseated him, Democrat Paul Penzone, left office early, citing the monitor and saying it hampered his ability to do his job. Now there is a groundswell of leaders calling for an end to the monitor's work, including several members of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors and Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell. They cite the soaring cost of the monitor, an estimated $350 million by next year. And they showed up in force at a recent community meeting about the case in Maryvale to voice their opinions. We'll hear from one of those in opposition later in the show. But first, let's turn to Raul Pina. He's a member of the Community Advisory Board charged with overseeing MCSO's compliance with the court order. He says that community meeting got ugly and racially charged.
I was shocked by what happened in Maryvale. It seems like there was a collaborative effort to bring people to the event, which is fine. If they want to talk about fiscal responsibility, that's fine. The concern and the shock comes from some of the comments from the audience towards the speakers, towards specifically the plaintiff's class members, Hispanic people, Native American people. There was significant backlash with a lot of racial slurs hurled at the speakers, and that was really disturbing.
So let's talk about what we heard from some of those officials you mentioned who came, from members of the County Board of Supervisors to the county attorney speaking afterward. There were lots of leaders there and afterward voicing concern about the price tag here, about the cost. $350 million is projected here. This is a lot of money. And I wonder what your reaction is to that. Do you think that that's a fair assessment at this point, this many years in?
The Community Advisory Board has asked Maricopa County Sheriffs and Maricopa County for an itemized report. If indeed it's $350 million, that's a huge amount of money. So we want to spend the money in a way that brings us closer to reform. We haven't had a report since 2022. Mm-hmm. So we've asked the monitor, asked the court for a report of that. We want to know if, in fact, these funds are being spent on Melendrez-related costs. There have been some costs that have been attributed to Melendrez that are actually operating expenses. There's been new leased buildings on Central Avenue for PSB. There's been technology. There's been hiring of people for recruitment purposes, et cetera. That can not all be Melendrez related. And so we want to know the details just like everyone else.
So it sounds like you're skeptical, though, that all of that $350 million is going toward the monitor.
We're skeptical because we have not received a report for a few years at this point, and we've asked for a detailed accounting of the money. Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you about the timing of this as well, because we're at this moment, this political moment, right, where the tides are turning on a lot of conversations like this. Like, we saw the Department of Justice pretty much drop its investigation into the Phoenix Police Department. We're seeing immigration crackdowns around the country, lots of local law enforcement cooperating with immigration authorities, which has been controversial in the past. Why do you think this push to get rid of the monitor and settle this is happening now?
I think it makes sense politically to attach a political campaign to this effort. It really does make sense to say loudly that we're spending $350 million. I get that. Politically, it may gain some votes somewhere down the line.
Let me ask you where the sheriff's office stands right now in terms of compliance in this case. The details of this get very in the weeds. But from your perspective, what else do they need to do this many years in to comply?
They are closer than they have ever been. Now what they need to do is clean up the backlog of complaints. That still is an issue. Mm-hmm. They're working themselves through that. There is still some data that indicates that there is bias at traffic stops. That is still the big concern. That's the big one for the Community Advisory Board. Mm-hmm. So they need to comply with those two big issues.
Right. And this was centered around traffic stops, right, and racial profiling of people during traffic stops. You're saying those issues have not been resolved. How is it measured?
I'll give you a couple of examples. Mm-hmm. Stops involving Hispanic drivers were more likely to result in an arrest than stops involving white drivers. This comes from TSAR 2024. Mm-hmm. Stops involving all racial or ethnic minority drivers were more likely to result in a search and an arrest than stops involving white drivers.
Raul, what do you hear from the community about statistics like that? Are those lived experiences you still hear about as a member of the Community Advisory Board? And how does what happened at the meeting play into that?
We still hear some of the similar concerns. We still hear concerns about racial profiling. We still hear concerns about interactions with law enforcement. We still hear that people are apprehensive about calling law enforcement because of what they see on television, because of the history of the Melendrez case. So the most recent community meeting held in Maryville really set us back. Mm. It was a significant moment. If there was momentum to bring us closer to compliance, if there was momentum to begin to rebuild trust with the agency, that was a huge moment that took us in the other direction.
How much does what's happening with ICE right now play into this as well? Are you hearing people be, once again, like they were when this case was being litigated initially, afraid to call law enforcement?
I believe that's true. I mean, we also hear about investigations and raids that are happening at Home Depot, for example, and other job sites. That is happening, maybe not at the scale of in California, but these raids are happening all over the country, and that alone brings fear. Mm-hmm. And now you have an agency that has a history of participating in those things. The burden of proof is on the agency to show that we are not that agency anymore. We are not that leadership anymore. We are different. We are better. We have evolved into this better place. And my concern is that they are not embracing this opportunity to show if, in fact, they have evolved.
Let me flip this on its head for a moment and just ask you about the price tag one more time. I mean, like, $350 million is a lot of money. And as you say, the board has requested a breakdown of that to make sure it all is actually going toward the monitor. But do you think you can put a price tag on justice like this?
We have to always go back to why we're here, why this case is even filed, why we're in this reform process. And the issue is racial profiling. My thought is we can't put a price tag on it because ultimately someone's life is being impacted and potentially changed forever at a traffic stop based on their skin color. And we have to spend whatever money, utilize whatever resources we need to make sure that doesn't happen. That's malpractice, and it's unconstitutional still, as far as I know.
All right. Raul Pina, member of the Community Advisory Board here joining us. Raul, thank you for coming back on. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Now let's turn to one of the county leaders who says it's time to move on. Republican Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell held a press conference after that community meeting in Maryvale, accusing the monitor of having a financial incentive to keep MCSO under court oversight. I sat down with her in our studios to talk about her concerns and how she says the monitor's requirements hamper her department's work as well.
One of the things that we're seeing is they're being diverted into doing so many different PSB, Professional Standards Bureau, investigations into non-detective, non-sworn positions that they're not actually focusing on the sworn necessarily. They're not able to focus those individuals who are being used to do that on detecting crime, putting cases together. So it slows everything down.
I want to ask you about some of the concerns that are still pointed out in the most recent monitor's report. So per 2024 numbers, there was still pretty solid evidence that, for example, traffic stops, if you are a Latino, if you are a minority, you are more likely to spend more time at a traffic stop with an MCSO officer and also to result in arrest. There are also still backlog concerns about the number of cases that have yet to be investigated. Some of those real problems, even though the department is and everyone on board has admitted this, like, pretty close to compliance, how do you think the department should address those concerns, those documented concerns going forward without a monitor?
Well, you know, it's interesting that this monitor, Robert Warshaw, has equated extra time spent on a stop to racism. Hmm. What he doesn't do is he doesn't look at the individual circumstances of a stop and say, why was that longer? Maybe it could be because they had a conversation. Maybe it could be because somebody didn't have as strong a command of the English language and maybe they waited for somebody to translate or it just took longer to get through. These are all reasons that are not related to ethnicity or race that could explain that. But he doesn't do that. He looks just at the bare number of time.
Mm-hmm. What about when it comes to the other side of that coin, though? Those stops are also more likely to result in arrest.
Well, I mean, I don't know if that's a situation where they're being more selective in who they're stopping because of this monitor situation. Mm. I mean, the reality is if you have a patrol officer or a deputy who is patrolling an area that is largely white, non-Hispanic, they're not going to be as afraid to stop people. And so that might lead to more traffic tickets, et cetera. But in heavily Hispanic or minority areas, they may do fewer stops. And so those might be more selective and you might have a higher arrest rate.
It's interesting.
Out of that.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing your perspective on this. So do you think that the monitor itself, like the oversight that deputies know exists here, is affecting their policing?
Absolutely. No question that it's affecting their policing.
Do you think in good ways or bad?
I think in bad ways, and I think it's having the reverse impact that everybody wants it to have. Mm. You have to keep in mind, you have a federal monitor here who to date has been paid, or at least his firm has been paid, $34 million, and that's just by us. That's not all the other locations he's been at. For example, he's also been the monitor in Oakland for over 20 years. This guy is making bank to tell people you're not safe and they're not doing it right.
Let me ask you a question about that price tag, because we interviewed another member of the Community Advisory Board who agrees that's a lot of money, mm-hmm. but also said, you know, they have been as a Community Advisory Board trying to get a breakdown of the costs for a long time and haven't gotten it. They're suspicious that all of that $300 million or more is attributable to the monitor. Is that a fair ask?
Well, it's interesting because we've been trying to get a breakdown of how this money is being spent as well.
Right.
And some of it has been put under court seal so that we can't actually see the breakdown of where the money is going. I'd love to see where all of the money is going.
Is the idea of stopping the monitor at this point, especially given the legacy of Sheriff Joe Arpaio and the conflict with the Latino community here that this case came out of, is this putting a price tag on stopping racial profiling, on justice?
It's not if it's not going on. I mean, it's if you're just paying money to tell people you should be scared, but the problem is solved, then it's putting a price tag on things that don't exist and paying somebody to tell the Hispanic community, for example, that there's a reason to be afraid of the sheriff's office.
This is happening at an interesting political moment, and there have been accusations that this push to get rid of the monitor right now is happening because of that political context, right?
I'm still waiting for an uninteresting political moment.
That is a fair point.
Yeah.
But, right, we're seeing, you know, the Department of Justice under the Trump administration drop the investigation into the Phoenix Police Department for similar concerns. Do you think that there's a reason this is happening now?
Well, I think that there was a movement under previous administrations to have federal overtake of local law enforcement. And I think that's very inappropriate, except in the most extreme circumstances. The reason for that is you have other methods to address it. Hmm. Arpaio was voted out of office. That was appropriate. It's really serious when you try to nationalize police forces. I looked at the Phoenix DOJ report, and they were taking selective facts. We even saw examples of that in my own office. They made it sound like the state bar came in and cleaned up the county attorney's office in their report. I cleaned up the county attorney's office, but that's their bread and butter of the old DOJ was to take selective facts and make it sound scary and worse than it is in order to justify a national takeover of local law enforcement.
So while someone on the left right now might look at this and say this is politically motivated to get rid of the monitor right now, you say the monitor was politically motivated to begin with?
Absolutely.
Let me ask you about the fear in immigrant communities right now, which this is directly related to, right? That's where this case came from. We're at another moment now where you're seeing ICE raids, you're seeing federal law enforcement arresting people for immigration status all over the place, including here. And there is a lot of fear in the immigrant community because of what's happening. What would you like to say to the community that may be scared?
You know, I understand the fear. And that's one of the things that concerns me. As you know, I was a longtime sex crimes prosecutor before I became county attorney. And it wasn't uncommon for example, offenders to target people who were in the immigrant community because they felt like they wouldn't report as much. And I think that's a tragedy. So what I would say to them is, if something does happen to you, if you are a victim of crime, that is not what the Maricopa County Attorney's Office is about. We're about holding offenders accountable and working with you on keeping you here to testify. And so that part, in terms of my job, is very, very unfortunate.
In terms of what you do. What do you think it would say to this community if that investigation was closed before MCSO had reached full compliance? Do you think they would have the same kind of faith in their law enforcement?
I think it needs to be done with adequate communication. I don't think people realize how much the goalposts have moved over the years that this monitor has been in place. But as it will be portrayed, where it's just like, oh, we're stopping looking at this, and with the monitor having, you know, spread fear like he has, I think it will create fear. And I think that's incumbent upon us as elected and appointed officials to really communicate with the community that what was happening under Arpaio is not happening now. And frankly, and I can't say this strongly enough, will not be tolerated by the Maricopa County Attorney's Office.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Rachel Mitchell, Maricopa County Attorney, joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Whether or not the monitor continues his work is up to the judge in this case, of course, and we'll follow this story as it continues to play out. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Drug overdoses continue to kill Americans, nearly 108,000 in 2022. That year, more than 2,600 Arizonans died of drug overdoses. Opioids are, of course, still a big part of that, as the country continues to try to deal with that epidemic. Dr. Melody Glenn is trying to bring those numbers down. She's an emergency medicine and addiction medicine physician in Tucson and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. She's also the author of a new book called Mother of Methadone, which follows her own story of finding the field of harm reduction, as well as that of the physician who co-developed methadone treatment decades ago. Dr. Glenn spoke with our co-host Mark Brody more about this, and they started with her journey into the kind of medicine that she practices, because it was not the plan all along.
No, it wasn't. I just thought I was going to be a regular emergency medicine doc working in ERs somewhere around the country. And then I got interested in emergency medical services, so working with fire departments, ambulances. And then I was working in the county emergency department in Oakland, California, where they have a very robust addiction medicine program. So they start buprenorphine, which is the main treatment for opioid use disorder, along with methadone. And they start that in the emergency department several times a day. Patients are getting started on addiction treatment all the time, which is pretty rare for an emergency department. And once I saw how well that worked, it was really revolutionary for me. I had never heard of these medications before. I had never given them. I don't remember even learning about it in medical school or residency. I don't think I'm alone. I've talked to lots of other doctors and they've had similar experiences. So once I saw how well they worked, I was just sort of shocked and I wanted to do more of this. I wanted to make them more accessible. And then once I just kept seeing the lack of access to these medicines, it sort of took me down this whole new path.
Was there a particular moment where you realized, my goodness, like these actually work if I am in this kind of medicine, I can make this much of a difference?
I can think of three different patients that together had that effect for me. One was just the first time I saw buprenorphine. There was a man who came into the emergency department. He was vomiting. He was in horrible pain. He was shouting. Miserable, absolutely miserable. And then one of the residents suggested, hey, you know, this guy's in opioid withdrawal. Why don't you give him buprenorphine? I didn't know what this medicine was. I said, sure, you know, you've explained it pretty well to me. Let's try it. And then within 30 minutes, this guy was a whole different person, completely transformed. He had a button-down shirt. He was very polite, very kind. He was appreciative and wanted to go home. He was ready to leave. And I had just never seen that kind of rapid transformation, even in the ER, where things happen pretty fast. And then the second time was when I gave this medicine without anyone prompting me. It was a woman who came into the ER. I forget her circumstances, but she was in opioid withdrawal, wanted to stop using. I gave her this medicine. She felt normal, she said, for the first time in years. And she gave me a big hug. And that never happens in the ER. No one ever gives me a hug. So again, very transformative for me. And then the third time was when I was doing addiction medicine. I was newly into it. I had my own patients. And I just saw the progress that my patients were making once they were on these medicines. I had this woman that I talked to at first every week, and then every other week, and then every month. And she was just getting her life back together, and she was doing great. I couldn't believe the impact that this one medication had.
So given your experience, like, what goes through your mind when you see or hear about instances where the medicine is not really available to people who could use it?
And unfortunately, that's the case much of the time. Most physicians don't prescribe this medication. They don't start it. Some pharmacies are scared to distribute it. Half of the country doesn't even have access to a methadone clinic, which is a similar medicine, also very effective. So that's sort of the status quo, is that these medicines are hard to access. It's so much easier for my patients to get the poison, to get fentanyl, than it is for them to get the cure. And it just drives me crazy. This is the kind of thing that keeps me up at night.
Why do you think it is that in many places it can be so hard to get this medication?
I think the answer is multifold. Part of it is that medicine has sort of abandoned addiction treatment for the last 100 years. Ever since the 1914 Harrison Act and the subsequent Supreme Court case, United States versus Webb, maybe it's Webb versus United States, however the Supreme Court names go, doctors have been scared out of treating addiction. They were penalized for starting people on these medications that keep them in maintenance treatment. We were told we couldn't do it. And so doctors stopped dealing with addiction. They thought it was more of a moral failing, more of a crime. People were incarcerated instead. And so I think medicine just has not seen it as part of their wheelhouse for a very long time because of this historical precedent. Also, I think there's a lot of stigma. There's a lot of stigma around addiction. Again, I think lots of people don't realize that it's a medical condition and it's very treatable and it's very overregulated. These medications are highly regulated. Methadone is one of the most regulated outpatient medications in the country.
Do you think there's a different stigma associated with drug addiction than other kinds of addictions? And I think about, like, you know, you see TV commercials for treatments for example, like nicotine addiction. And it's, you know, there are all sorts of places people can go if they are addicted to alcohol or other kinds of substances. And yet it seems, as you're saying, that maybe drugs are still a little bit different.
I would agree with that completely.
Why do you think that
entirely
is?
I don't know. I mean, of course, they're criminalized. So I think that that's part of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, alcohol kills more people per year than opioids. But still, we don't really talk about the alcohol epidemic. We just accepted that harm, right? We've decided as a society, we want people to be able to drink alcohol regardless of the harms. And that's what we're going to do, I think, is part of it. And also, these other substances are criminalized. So they're seen as something nefarious and bad. I think there's also been a lot of racism with different illicit substances, too, where we peg the use of certain substances to certain ethnic groups.
So what's the way out of this then? Like, how do you try to convince more of your colleagues that this is a useful treatment and maybe convince policymakers that it should be more readily available?
I think we're making progress. I've seen progress ever since I came to Tucson in 2019, both locally and nationally. I think just as more folks speak up and talk about how well these medications work, how these how addiction is treatable. I think that's going to make a difference. And I'm also hoping that my book might make a difference, because for some people, I think their stigma around drugs is not really in the rational part of their brains, but more somewhere else, maybe in their hearts. And I'm hoping that a story might convince them if the facts and figures don't.
Is there something to say here about trying to deal with addiction on the front end and trying to prevent people or help them not get addicted to drugs in the first place?
Definitely. I think that would be the ultimate goal, is to prevent addiction. I think it's a hard one. I think humans throughout time have enjoyed using substances, so that's going to be something that persists. And lots of drug use and addiction is theorized to come from childhood trauma and other traumatic events in someone's life. So really, we want to do things to prevent those from happening in the first place.
I mean, it seems like this would be the kind of job where ideally you would kind of put yourself out of business, right?
Yes, I would love that. I would love to no longer be needed.
Can you envision a time when that would be the case?
I don't know. Maybe. Maybe. But there would just be other doctors probably replacing me. I don't think that we're going to end addiction anytime soon.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Dr. Melody Glenn, an emergency medicine and addiction medicine physician in Tucson, also an assistant professor of medicine at the University of Arizona College of Medicine, and author of the new book, Mother of Methadone. Melody, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Journalist Annalee Newitz has been reporting on robots for a long time. Newitz takes a particular interest in the way humans talk about robots and the often surprising gaps between what we fear they might be used for and what they're actually capable of. In addition to covering the latest robotic innovations for places like Wired, Popular Science, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, Newitz writes fiction. Newitz's books explore the psychological relationship between humans and tech more deeply, and that curiosity is on full display in Newitz's latest novella, Automatic Noodle. It tells the story of a group of robots in California who open a noodle shop. I spoke with Newitz recently about the backdrop of the story, which, Newitz says, starts with our inherent cultural fears about what the future holds.
A lot of it comes down to Terminator. We imagine these giant armored creatures, you know, crushing human skulls under their feet. And if you talk to roboticists right now who are working on cutting edge materials, a lot of our future robots will look nothing like that. Soft bodied robots are a huge growth area. This is really spongy material, different kinds of rubber, and, you know, almost flesh-like materials. And the idea is we want robots that are squishy, that can squeeze into places, that can swim.
Isn't that interesting, though, that there is something about that version of a robot that almost feels more unnerving or uncomfortable? The idea of a robot that's almost like a person is somehow almost more challenging to think about.
Yeah, these are not going to be squishy humanoid robots. A lot of robots are going to be purpose-built. And so you might see an octopus-shaped robot. Like if you saw one in the wild, you would say, oh, it's kind of a cute little guy.
Which is interesting to me in the context of Automatic Noodle, because part of what you're playing with here is the idea that these robots ultimately have to collaborate with their human neighbors, right? Everybody needs to get to know each other a little better.
That's right. Part of what I was trying to do in this book is challenge this idea that anytime we develop a sophisticated robot, it will instantly become our overlord. And I think that leads to this really skewed idea of what the technology will be. And so I wanted to imagine robots who just want to lead humble lives and make noodles and open a noodle restaurant right. That's just a little neighborhood place. And they have to learn what kinds of things humans might want to eat. And they have to work together with people.
At a certain point, these robots start making these really delicious noodles. And then there's this targeted wave of one-star reviews that gets directed at the robot's noodle business. And it's kind of an interesting idea, right? Because we see these things all the time in real life where people use bots to write, you know, fake reviews that are designed to either boost or tear down something that they want to focus attention on, whether it's a restaurant or a podcast or whatever the case may be. And here you're introducing this world where the robots are victims of the kind of attack that people in the real world sometimes use robots for. And it ends up being this lesson about collaboration with these beings that just want to help feed you.
It's a thought experiment, right? Mm-hmm. It's thinking about what if we actually did get these human-like robots that really were just like us. Of course, there would be robophobes out there who would be very challenged by that, in the same way that people now are challenged by the idea of immigrants coming and, you know, working alongside them, or people in their community who don't live the same kinds of lives that they do. And that's kind of what these robots are dealing with. It's people who aren't even in their neighborhood, who've never even tasted the noodles, who have no stake in whether this little tiny restaurant succeeds. They just hate the idea of robots having any kind of self-sufficiency.
And I have to say, when I saw that you had written this book, I was reminded of the reporting that you did about 10 years ago on Ashley Madison, which is, well, let's have you tell people what Ashley Madison is so I don't mangle it.
It's just a social site for meeting people who want to cheat on their spouses. So the idea is that you can meet someone to have an illicit hookup with. And what I and many other journalists discovered when there was a big data dump from their code base was that actually all of the real people on the site were heterosexual men, and they were talking to bots. There were thousands and thousands of fake women on the site who were just having these very silly conversations with the men. But the dark side of that was that these poor guys were getting money suckered out of them because you had to pay to respond to messages. And so this was just, you know, a money pit.
Right. Well, what's so fascinating to me about this, Annalee, is I believe you published that reporting in 2015, so 10 years ago.
And that's right.
Of course, now we are seeing stories of people not just interacting with chatbots romantically, but in some cases proposing marriage to them, in some really horrific cases harming themselves because their AI romantic partner isn't responding to their emotions the way they hoped they would. A lot of these people are paying to have those interactions. If anything, what you reported on, which seemed so surreal at the time, has become even more widespread.
It's become really mainstream. You know, this is something that is very human of us. People have always had this propensity to anthropomorphize everything from statues to non-human animals to ideas themselves. You know, we're really good at kind of imagining that we're getting a human response from something that's not human. What's happening with ChatGPT now and people developing romantic attachments to it as really just a twist in that basic piece of human psychology. Yeah. And that's actually in some ways very sweet. And of course, it's also very dangerous if you have a corporation that is deliberately using their software to manipulate people into giving more data to that software or paying money. There are companies behind it who are getting value out of our love.
So, but in that vein, it strikes me that you're up against a very interesting challenge in writing this book, because you, of course, want people to, I don't know if love your characters is the right word, but empathize with them, you know, like really relate to them. So how did you think about that?
Yeah, it's a super good question. And part of the answer is that these are metaphorical robots, right? These are not actual pieces of technology that exist now.
Right.
These are not actual people. These are, in my world building for the story, I was imagining that these were somehow people, that these were robots that had demonstrated that they were essentially human equivalent, that they really had the same kinds of social relationships and emotions that humans do. And so they'd been granted civil rights and they are actually citizens. And so I think that once you set those rules down and you're saying that these are actually people, then you can start to tell a story about how do we treat people who are new citizens of a nation? How do we treat people who are different from us? But at the same time, I also did want to kind of nudge people to think about the way we talk about robots and AI right now, because if we were to actually get something more like a human being out of those products, I think what you would see is that immediately those people, like imaginary people that don't exist yet, that those people would be essentially enslaved by corporations. I don't think that a company like AI is interested in inventing people that can go free.
Well, the story is Automatic Noodle, and it is written by Annalee Newitz, who is also a science journalist. And Annalee will be at Changing Hands on August 7th. Annalee, thank you for this conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
A great noodle and robot note to end the show on.
Yeah, just noodling on some very futuristic ideas.
That'll do it for today's edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning. Mark will have your Friday news cap, as always. And you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.